I actually want you to get your songbooks back out. Same ones. Because there's a song in here that we're gonna sing as kind of a basis of my lesson for this afternoon. And normally I have to write it up on the board, but it happens to be in these songbooks. So that's nice. Yes, your Faith and Praise ones, the ones we had. 693 is what song that is. And we'll sing it through twice. Okay? We'll sing it through twice. Give me the heart of a servant, tender and faithful and true. Fill me with love and use me, O Lord, so that the world can see you. Give me the heart of a servant, tender and faithful and true. Fill me with love and use me, O Lord, so that the world can see you. Is that new to you guys? Let's do that again then. Because I want you to go away knowing this song. Give me the heart of a servant, tender and faithful and true. Fill me with love and use me, O Lord, so that the world can see you. All right. Isn't that a wonderful song? Teaches us so much. It teaches us about being a servant, what that means. And that's what I want to talk a little bit about. Now, don't run away on that song because we're going to sing it again in a little bit. So you might have to fold that out or double mark it somehow. Being a servant is an interesting idea. Jesus pointed out that the Son of Man came to be what? Remember, we're talking about being a servant. He came to serve, not to be served. To serve, not to be served. Now, how many people do you know in your life that's their goal? To serve instead of to be served. Because most of us know a whole lot of people that like to be served. Right? They want everything done for them or given for them, and they don't want to have to work very hard for it, and that's like their goal in life. The common conception is that the current generation of high school to college age to young adult has that mindset, right? The me generation, they call them. That I want what's mine, and I want what's not mine, too. I want it all. Now, it's interesting because Jesus pointed out that that's just the opposite of what he was when he was here. He had one goal, and that was to serve others. Now, were there people that provided for his need? Was he served while he was here? Yeah, but that wasn't his goal. If somebody decided to provide him a place to sleep for the night, or if somebody decided to anoint his head with costly oil or his feet, that was it just happened. He wasn't looking for that. Does that make sense? He was looking for opportunities to do things for others. That's what he was there for. Now, if we look in Matthew chapter 20, Jesus gives a little lesson on the idea of being a servant. Matthew chapter 20, and I'm going to start reading in verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" She said to him, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit one on your right hand and the other on the left in your kingdom." Did they come to be served or to serve? To be served. Mom brought him along and said, "When you are king of this vast empire that you're going to have," because she didn't understand what was going on, "make sure that my sons get their due portion." Is that what she wanted? No. Make sure they get the best. Because obviously my boys are the most important. Now what mother doesn't feel that way? That their kids are the best. They're the smartest. They're the most talented. They're the nicest. Right? Moms tend to think that. Dads do too. Okay? But this just happens to be a mom. Make sure that my boys get what's best. Is that what Jesus plans on doing? I don't think so. Notice he turns this into a lesson on leadership, which I think is kind of interesting. He talks about himself. "You want to be my left hand and my right hand." Now, in physical kingdom terms, that would have been the most powerful and the second in command, right? In the kingdom, or third technically in command in the kingdom. That's where we get the phrase, "my right hand guy," my right hand man. Because it can't work without him. I can't do anything without him. He's very important to me. So we get to have this idea, right? Jesus starts out talking about him. Can you do the things? You want to sit up here with me? You want to be my right-hand guy? Can you do the things I'm going to have to do? Now, when he talks about the cup that I'm going to drink and the baptism I'm going to be baptized with, what is he referring to? His death. He's referring to his suffering, the whippings, the beatings that he's going to have to go through, the mental anguish, and then the baptism would be his literal death, his burial in the tomb, and then coming out of it. I mean, that's right. That's what he talks about, and what the apostles talk about. Baptism, in this ceremonial sense, is. It's a recreation of the death, the burial, and the resurrection. So he says, can you be baptized with the baptism I'm going to be baptized with? Well, they think they can, but they don't even know what that is. They don't even know what he's doing yet. They don't understand it. So Jesus turns around, because in verse 24, what about the other 10? Yeah. Is there some jealousy going on here? Perhaps. Maybe some, why didn't I think to ask that? What was I doing? Now they're going to outrank me. I'm going to have to bow down to these two guys? So Jesus gives them a lesson on leadership, starting in verse 25. He said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man," oh, here's that verse, "did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." See, this is Jesus explaining who he is, why he's here, and then explaining, you got to be like me. You have to be a servant. Now, that doesn't mean people can't do nice things for you and people can't help you out on occasion and people can't serve you. But if that's our goal, because he points out that's the goal of the rulers of the Gentiles, they're all about themselves. What can I get out of this relationship? Instead of, what can I do to serve? Now, over in Matthew chapter 23, that was about the Gentiles, right? So these other Gentile nations around here have kings and lords and princes that rule with the iron fist. My way or the highway, you are there to kiss my feet, therefore you will do what I tell you to do. Well, it would be easy for those Jewish guys to think, well, yeah, that's right. That's how the Gentiles are. They're all like that. Those dirty, filthy, rotten Gentiles. Lower than a snake's belly. Those horrible people. Of course they act like that. Because they're heathens. Right? That would be the natural course of their thought. So it's interesting to me that over in verse 23, or chapter 23, Jesus has more to say to them. Only this time he's going to talk about the Jews. In verse 2, he tells them the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. What does he mean by that? He means a leadership position. He's talking about that they're sitting in. What did Moses do that nobody else had done up to that point? I mean, other people had led the people. Other people led the people later. He gave them a law. And then he judged them based on that law. So Jesus, in essence, he's already insulted the scribes and Pharisees because he said they're sitting in Moses' seat. They're acting as lawgivers. And then they're judging on that law that they give, which they weren't supposed to do. So anyway, verse 3, therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not do according to their works. For they say and do not do. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders. But they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all their works they do to be seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. They love the best places at feasts and the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. He says everything they do, whether it's a good deed for somebody or a teaching or a hi, how are you, everything they do is to bring attention and glory to themselves. Because that's what they're about. They're all about themselves. He's bringing it down to the Jews now. The Jewish leaders are acting like this. That's very similar to what the Gentile leaders were acting like as they lorded over. Isn't it interesting, too? I don't want to go there yet or at all, really. I wasn't going to talk about this, but it just popped into my mind to bring this up. Isn't it Paul that tells elders not to what over the flock? Lord it over the flock. Well, this is where he got this teaching. This is where he got this understanding of a leader, a ruler, is not supposed to be a maniacal dictator that is out only for himself. It's supposed to be out to serve, out to do for others. So then he goes on, talks a little bit more about some of these things. But look at verse 11 again. But he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. And whoever exalts himself will be humbled. And he who humbles himself will be exalted. Jesus keeps driving this point home that if you want to be a leader, you have to serve. You have to be all about being a servant. So now turn to Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14. Verse 1. Now it happened as he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath, they watched him closely. They're watching him closely. But look down at verse 7. So he told a parable to those who were invited when he noted how they chose the best places. He's watching them carefully. They're watching him carefully so they can trip him up and make him look like a fool and discredit him. He's watching them closely so that he can teach and encourage and hopefully change their attitudes and what they do. You see the difference? They're watching him because they want to get something out of it for themselves. He's watching them so that he can hopefully serve and do something to better them. See, it's a completely different mindset, even though they're both doing the same things. Now, you remember that in the last passage we read, he talked about how the scribes and the Pharisees, those that sat in Moses' seat, what did they do at the feasts? He already knew this. What did they do? They wanted the high places. They wanted the high places. Now, you can understand that. You've got this long table, right, for this big feast. And here at the head of the table, The spot of honor is the one hosting. All right? The one hosting. Now, most of the people that are invited are going to want to sit as close to that host as they can, because the closer you can sit to the host, the more important you are. The more involved in the conversation that you are with the host or about the host, or that the host is interested in talking in, if you're sitting clear over here at the foot of the table, you might not even have any idea what they're talking about up there, right? Because we see it at basket dinners on small tables, or even family dinners around a round table. You might have two or three or four different conversations going on all at the same time. And he noticed how, just like he'd said before, they all want to sit up at the top. So in verse 8, when you're invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest one more honorable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you and him come and say to you, give place to this man. And then you begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit down in the lowest place, so that when he who invited you comes, he may say to you, friend, go up higher. Then you will have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Do you think Jesus really cared who was the most important person at that feast? I don't think so. It didn't matter to him. He was there to serve. He didn't care who it was he was serving. Now, I find this interesting, because we don't think about the Lord in these terms, but when I read this, I can hear Jesus being a little sarcastic, can't you? Because he really could care less who sits where. And I don't think he's really trying to give them political savvy advice on how to look more important than you really are. Because that's not why he came either. I think what he's doing is he's using a real world example of what they're actually doing right there in his presence to help teach them a lesson. If you go and you sit right next to the head of the table, and all of a sudden, here come three governors and four senators, and you realize, uh-oh, I may have overstepped my position. And somebody comes up and has to say, I'm sorry, Doug, but this is not your seat. You're down there. Now I'm embarrassed. Now I'm ashamed. And now everybody's going to whisper and make fun of me. Instead, what I should do is sit clear at the bottom, because that's either my spot or somebody's going to come to me and say, oh, Doug, no. You shouldn't be sitting down here. You should be sitting up here. And even if it's the middle, oh, now I'm honored in the presence of all. So he's even telling them, you're trying to be honored in front of everybody, and you don't even know how to do that. You're getting that wrong. But then he adds to the end, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. I don't have a count, but that is said how many times in the New Testament? By Christ, by Paul, over and over and over. If you want to be the greatest, be a servant. Now, here's the thing. I also know people, maybe you do too, I also know people that go around and do a lot of things for other people. And just like the Pharisees, they want everybody to know all the good things they're doing for all the people, right? It's out for themselves. It's time to glorify me, because I want you to know how much money I give to this charity. I want you to know how much time I spend for this facility to help them out. I want you to know all the extra stuff I do. Well, that's not about serving. That's about exalting myself. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, I think Paul addresses this kind of as a secondary issue, but I still think it's addressed. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, he's talking about love, right? That's the point. But I want you to notice a couple of things. You know, you remember those first three verses, right? That kind of, sometimes it feels like they don't fit. I mean, you don't see those verses up on a plaque. You see love is kind, love is patient, love is... You see that on a plaque or a wall hanging. But you don't see, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels. You don't see that on the plaque. We know those verses, but we kind of almost, even consciously, we separate them. But I want you to look especially for our topic at the third verse. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Those are good deeds. That's serving others, right? Providing food, providing clothing perhaps, providing money, even to the point of giving up my own body, everything I am, giving up for somebody else. Is that a good thing? The right answer is it depends. It depends. It could be, it's always going to be a good thing in that the person that needs is going to be benefited. But whether it's a good thing for me or not, in doing that giving or doing that serving depends on the motivation behind it. Because here, he says, though I do all this stuff, if I don't have love. If I don't have love. And then he goes on and defines love. In other words, if I'm walking down the street and I see some poor guy sitting there on the side of the road with a sign and I've got a $20 bill in my pocket and I decide I'm going to give that $20 bill to that guy. And I pull it out of my pocket and I walk over to him and I say, here you go. Here's $20. I hope that helps out. And I turn around to make sure I see who noticed me putting some money in his little hat. That's one thing. But if I walk up to him and very quietly say, here, I want to help a little. And maybe I stand and talk to him. And maybe I try to share a little bit of the gospel with him. That's a whole different motivation, isn't it? Now I'm not doing it for me, I'm doing it for him. Because it's all about the motivation. That's what he says in all three of those first three verses. Whether it's speaking in tongues or having prophecy or being able to teach or having great faith or physically serving somebody else. If the motivation behind that is not love for that individual, then I might as well just walked on by. Because it's not doing anything for me. It's actually doing something against me. It's not helping me at all. And it's not helping me, not because I'm concerned about helping me, but because if I'm going to serve people, I want it to be something that the Lord will exalt, right? Not the people standing around watching. I could care less what they think. It's about humbling myself so that God can exalt me. The motivation behind the service is extremely, extremely important. Let's look at a real world example. Genesis chapter 13. Genesis chapter 13, we have a situation here. We have a situation with Abraham and Lot. And their herds and their families have grown to the point that they're kind of knocking heads over who gets the pasture land, who gets the best parts, who gets the pond now, who gets what. And Abraham and Lot really aren't having an issue. They're fine, but their servants aren't getting along. So they've got to figure out what to do about this. And I find their the contrast of the two of them's reaction pretty interesting. Look at verse 8. So Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me, and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right. If you go to the right, then I will take the left. Who is Abraham most interested in serving, himself or Lot? Lot. He's looking out for Lot. I don't want there to be any strife. I don't want there to be any conflict. I want to serve you, Lot. So he says, you pick. Wherever you want to go, you go. And if you go there, then I will go somewhere else. But look what Lot does in verse 10. And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, and like the land of Egypt as you go toward Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. Why did Lot go the direction he went? Because Lot was looking out for Lot. Lot wasn't looking out for Abraham. Look at all that Abraham had done for Lot. But Lot was all about me. What can I get? Well, he was not there to serve. He was there to be served. And then it says that Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. Look where that attitude got Lot. Yeah, he had great crop ground. He had nice little rivers. The Jordan, it's a nice little river. Plenty of water. Plenty of green grass. But boy, the price he had to pay, right? Whoever exalts himself will be humbled. Brought low. That's what happened to Lot. Lot thought more of himself than he did of Abraham. Even though if it wasn't for Abraham, Lot would have still been up north, barely making a living. I just find that interesting, the contrast in those two people. And you see that, you can see that too, throughout Abraham's life. Anytime he is anywhere, he is trying to help those that are around him. Even to the point of sending men, some of his men and servants off to war. To a fight that's not even his, because it was the right thing to do at the time. It's just amazing to me, the contrast in those two men. So let's go to Acts chapter 9. Acts chapter 9 and verse 36. At Joppa there was a certain disciple named Tabitha, which is translated Dorcas. This woman was full of good works and charitable deeds, which she did. But it happened in those days that she became sick and died. When they washed her, they laid her in an upper room. And since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples had heard that Peter was there. They sent two men to him, imploring him not to delay in coming to them. Then Peter arose and went with them. When he had come, they brought him to the upper room. And all the widows stood by him weeping, showing the tunics and garments which Dorcas had made while she was with them. She's just a woman, right? We don't see any mention of her husband, so I don't know if she was married or not. But we know one thing, don't we, about Dorcas, Tabitha. What's the one thing that we know about her? She served others. She was a giver. She was there not to be served, but to serve. And when she died, can you just imagine being there and being Peter? Do you suppose Peter knew Dorcas? I don't know. I think it's possible. She was a member of the church there. I imagine he'd met her. I imagine he knew her name somehow. I don't know if there was a personal connection. I don't know if he knew her well. But I have a feeling that he knew who she was. He's in a town nearby. But when he shows up, he doesn't mention where she's at. He doesn't mention the scenario. He doesn't mention all the mourners. Necessarily that way, just that they're mourning her death. He doesn't mention that the house is a nice little house by the seaside and the windows open and it's pleasant and it's pretty and what a wonderful service they're about to have for this poor sister that just passed away. He doesn't mention any of that. He mentions that he sees a whole lot of widows there. And what did they bring? They brought examples. Here's how she served me. Here's how she served me. Here's how she served me. I've often wondered, how many people that was a surprise to. I've often wondered how many people knew everything she had done. She's honored as a servant and as a giver. So something tells me she was in her closet. She was giving secretly. And I don't mean that nobody knew, but she wasn't drawing attention to herself. And God, who saw in secret, rewarded her openly. What a great testimony. What a great testimony it would be, right? Isn't it wonderful to go to somebody's funeral service, to somebody's farewell party, and you hear all the list of things that they did for other people? What I'm amazed at is when I go to somebody's service and I hear all the things that they did to serve other people, and as people are talking about, and I don't mean like from up front, I mean just in conversation around too, and I find out that I didn't know they did that. Wow, I had no idea they were doing that for them. They had the heart of a servant then. That has to be it. That's really the only explanation. So now turn to 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. You ever wonder how it was that Paul was able to walk in to a town that had a synagogue, and when he left, they had a growing, thriving congregation of the Lord's body? You ever wonder how he was able to do that? How he was able to just walk into a town, maybe there is no synagogue, and go to Mars Hill and start talking, and before too long, there's a growing, strong congregation of the Lord's body in that area. I've often thought about that myself. How did he do that? Did he have some special recipe of words that he said? He had a certain order of scripture that he brought up, or teachings of Christ that he brought up, that just, wow, that just convicted everybody? I don't think so. I don't think so. I think what he had was this. Look in chapter 9, starting with verse 19. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win the more. And to the Jew I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, not being without law toward God, but under law toward Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Now I do this for the gospel's sake, that I may be a partaker of it with you. You see that connection? He was making it a point to be a servant for the gospel's sake. He was the one that walked by and found that person that needed something, helped them out, and used that as an opportunity to tell them about Christ. That's how he did it. When he was with Jews, he became as a Jew. I don't think that means he acted like a Jew and talked like a Jew and walked like a Jew and dressed like a Jew. I think what it means is that when he was with the Jews, he figured out what the Jews needed and found a way to serve them. When he was with a Gentile, he figured out what the Gentiles needed and found a way to serve them. That's what we can see, isn't it? We can see that from when he goes from town to town to town to town. He talks to this group of Jews, and it's one message. He talks to this group of Jews, it's the same root message, Jesus Christ and him crucified, but he flavors it in a way that's going to serve them. And he gets so used to going into synagogues that you'd think when he gets to Athens, well, there's no synagogue. Well, now what do I do? So what does he do? He goes walking around. He does what Jesus did. He watches and observes. Pretty soon, he realizes, an idol to the unknown God. I think that'll work. And he begins to tell them about this God they don't know about. What a novel idea. I'm sure that he had some measure of spiritual inspiration when he was doing these things. I'm confident of that. But at the same time, we have it right here, how he was able to walk into a place he'd never been before. And when he left sometime later, there was a growing, strong congregation of the Lord's body. Because he became their servant. He found a way to supply what they needed and then used that for the gospel's sake. That's how he describes it. So that he might win the more. At least, he says, I might win some. He knew he wouldn't get the whole town necessarily, but he sure tried. It's because we're supposed to be a servant. That's why Jesus emphasized to his apostles and to his disciples and all his multitude of followers, if you want to really do something, then be a servant. And Paul took that to heart. And he became a servant. But that servant has to have a certain heart, right? Has to have a certain heart. That's why I started out with this song, The Heart of a Servant. Why don't you pull that out again? Because this, to me, is a very good job of describing at least the core of what Jesus was talking about when he said, you need to be a servant. And when Paul said, I've become a servant so that they can hear the gospel. And this is the heart that we need to have as we try to spread it to others. So let's sing this song one more time, now that you know it so well. Know me, give me the heart of a servant, tender and faithful and true. Fill me with love and use me, O Lord, so that the world can see you. One more time. Give me the heart of a servant, tender and faithful and true. Fill me with love and use me, O Lord, so that the world can see you. So we have to decide, are we going to try to be servants, or are we going to try to make sure that we're on the left hand or right hand of the Father? What's most important to us? Are we here to be served, or are we here to serve? Does that service come from a place of love and from our heart? Or does it come from a place of doing our deeds so that all can see? And what's the end result of that service? Is the end result of that service that, well, they have some more food to eat, they have some more clothes to wear, they have a place that they can live? Or is the end of that service that their soul has an opportunity at salvation? What's going to be the end result of that service? Because all of that matters. All of that matters. The Son of God came to serve and not to be served. And that's completely fulfilled when he gives his life for us. Greater love has no man than to lay down his life. Because there's nothing more you can do. That's why it's the greatest love. The greatest expression of love. An even greater expression of love is when the Son of God does that for you. If you need to accept his sacrifice, if you need to let him serve you so that you can become a servant, then we invite you to come forward as we stand and as we sing.